open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
If there are any great truths in what these people have gone through and are going through, it's that there's no one size fits all.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Finkel talks about war and the effect it has on those who fight.
They thought if they got into anything, they were going to succeed, they were going to prevail, they were going to win. And by the end of it, that hadn't happened in most cases. The war ended, but the part these guys are in now, it is ongoing.
David Finkel is the national editor at the Washington Post and the author of two best-selling books about the war in Iraq, all told from the point of view of those who fought in it. The Good Soldiers was named a year's top 10 book by the New York Times, and it follows the lives of the men on the front lines in Baghdad. In his latest book, Thank You for Your Service, Finkel revisits these soldiers' lives after coming home. He starts off the program talking about the moment in history when The Good Soldiers takes place.
The first book I did, called The Good Soldiers, was about a point in the Iraq War in 2007-2008, the period known as the Surge. It was regarded by so many people as the war had reached its last chance, its tragic moment. And into that moment went a battalion of infantry soldiers from Fort Riley, Kansas, 800 guys, most deploying for the first time, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, and into the war they went, filled with that soldier sense of naive mission and a good sense of patriotism in many cases, and this unbelievable invincibility. They were going to win the war. And then they got there, and by chance they got a pretty tough neighborhood in East Baghdad. And then the first guy died, and then the second guy died, and then soldiers began losing arms and legs and eyes. And as the bombs kept going off and their souls darkened a bit, it changed for them. You know, war did what war does. It became a degrading experience. So by the time they came home, I was with them through the deployment, and when they came home 15 months later, they were, of course, changed. And then I did this. The next book is about what happened next, because after the book was published, I began hearing from soldiers saying, I'm anxious, I'm depressed. There were a few suicide tries, and clearly something was up. And I realized I had written the first half of the story, but the second half, the after-war, still needed to be told.
Mm-hmm. That's what you call it, the after-war.
I do.
Talk about yourself for a moment. Where were you? Where was your life? You met today with the Black and Gold students at Central, and one of them asked you, did you believe in the war while you were covering it? And it was an interesting question about your own relationship to the subject matter. So tell us, number one, how you fit into the war and how you came upon these. I mean, what was it that drew you in about Adam or Saskia? What was their sensibility that attracted you as a storyteller?
Well, imagine if you're a storyteller. I mean, the moment when a group of guys is going into what's presumed to be the tragic moment of something, what will happen to them? That's an interesting moment to be a writer. And by that point in the war, there had been great policy books. Memoirs were starting to come out. But there had been no journalistic documentation of the corner of the war that was inhabited, as I described, at the far end of policy. The soldiers on the ground trying to pull this thing off or do what they were doing. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting moment. And my journalistic style is not to visit a story, but to embed in it, to stay with it. So not to interview, but just to see. So that's why I stayed over there for so long. Of the 14 months on the ground, I was with them for most of them. And it was the same way for this new book. They came home. They were clearly, in some cases, in trouble. So I found people I wanted to write about, and I basically spent a couple of years living with them and to write the story of what they were going through.
I wrote in the Times, Finkel has made art out of a defining moment in history, and this is about The Good Soldiers, that first book. You will be able to take this book down from the shelf years from now and say, this is what happened, this is what it felt like. What is the role of the reporter, in your own words, living today in well, back then when you were writing the book, but talk about the role of reporting. Is it your job to make art? Is it your job to be an advocate? Is it your job to... Who are you speaking to and for?
Well, in my case, the way I think of it, it might be a little tunnel vision. It's none of those things. I was intrigued by a question. The question was not to write about war, but to use war to write about the character of young men. What, and I didn't know the answer. What happens? What is it to be a young man sent into a war like this at this particular moment? What happens?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So, when I went over there, my promise to the battalion commander was that I had no agenda. I wasn't going to write a first-person book. I wasn't going to pronounce the war good or bad, the surge of success or a failure. That's not the point. The point was bigger than that. The point was to write about the interior struggles of a young man feeling invincible and mm-hmm. then coming home changed. So it's not a matter of seeing this thing in any kind of grand way, but the smallest way possible, just documenting that corner.
You practice what I would call immersion journalism. You're very immersed in your subject.
Yeah.
Tell us who some of your antecedents are. Who's paved the way for you? Because I want to tell the audience that if you like your nonfiction as a page-turner, you're going to like David Finkel's writing, because Ann Stanton was reading this book yesterday, and she was turning the pages reading and said, I can't believe this book, and I can't stop reading it, because it is so engrossing. I think you're writing about a growing class of Americans that many of us walk among but don't take time to meet. And I think Alan Newton's exhibit in the lobby is another example of a window into that world. But who are the antecedents for this immersion journalism?
Well, there's a ton. I'll mention one in particular. But first, I have to tell you something first, which I meant to say a minute ago. One of the great thrills of life, and you have to bear with me here, to wake up one day and, first of all, to see that a book you've written and you expect it to disappear because it's about these wars didn't disappear, but it gets a review in the Sunday New York Times. And second, the reviewer is Doug Stanton. And third, those lines are in the review. You know, things like you can take this book down years from now, reread it, and you'll think to yourself, this is what happened, and this is how it felt. And I thought, oh my God, that's exactly the point of the journalism I'm trying to do, to get down what happened and to convey how it felt. That was a pretty good day.
Let me intercede. Was it better than the day you got the phone call from the MacArthur Foundation? And suddenly they told you were a genius.
Well, I spent a better part of both those days disbelieving both, actually.
Yeah. But I just want to follow that for a moment.
Once you found out that you were a genius, what did you have to stop doing? I have to tell you just one person to read who I think is a model of this.
Okay,
kind of
we'll come to the genius thing later. I'm not going to let you get up.
So, I mean, there's a history of this, and I was lucky enough to be wandering around, totally lost in life, wondering what to do with myself. I happened to be in Florida, and it was in the late 70s, and there was this really vibrant form of journalism taking hold in the state, in the St. Pete Times and the Miami Herald, where it wasn't just information.
You were working at St. Pete. You were working at St. Pete, right?
Well, I was in school at that point at the University of Florida, doing my best to not do anything at all. But I did read some newspapers now and then, and I was just seized by some of these stories. These names won't matter. Barry Barak, Sarah Reimer, Maddie Blaze. Just I started reading this stuff and thought, this is what I want to do. And they mattered. I still read their stuff. It holds up over time. Amazing.
What was it that caught you?
This is what happened. This is how it felt. I was being told stories. I was being given journalism, but it didn't feel like you have to read this. This is a dose of medicine. It was done in a way where you just couldn't stop reading it.
Mm-hmm.
A better person can just read flat, straight nonfiction and learn from it, but I guess I need a little help. Which mm-hmm. I guess gets to that genius part of it. These were great stories, and I wanted to do it. And you know, the best example I can think of, the most extraordinary current example, is this woman, Catherine Boo, who is a fearless reporter. and a writer of sentences I can only dream of. And she
Tell us the name of her book.
Behind the Beautiful Forevers, and you all should go buy this book. It sounds like one of these books you don't want to read. It's about life in a slum in India. Oh my God. It's from the first sentence you just can't stop reading it.
Right.
You learn about the world, you learn about people, you learn about yourself. And I'd like to think that, you know, the books I've done offer a version of that.
Yeah, I think they do. I know the book The Things They Carried, which is a novel by Tim O'Brien, was important to you as you wrote Thank You for Your Service. Tell us why and tell us what... let's talk a moment about the difference between fiction and nonfiction, since O'Brien's a novelist.
Mm-hmm. Well, what that book does for me is it reminded me of a few things. One, how writing doesn't have to be linear. You can go back and back at a fact and re-examine it through different characters and different points in time, almost this elliptical approach to it, and each time the moment becomes ever more gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a good thing to keep in mind as I tried to write about war and then write about the effects of after war. What I try to do in my books is write a book that feels like a novel. Characters you quickly care about, facing some situation, what will happen? Will they overcome it? You know, just the usual standard arc of writing.
How do you do that, though? I mean, tell us, I think there are a lot of writers in the audience, and we all love reading this stuff, but how do you take all that information and, like, if you took today, what you did today, how would you write about it in a novelistic fashion?
I don't know yet, because I don't know enough about today. Even though we're at the end of it, and I've experienced...
It ends well, by the way.
No, actually, it doesn't. I need to tell you how it ends. So in the case of the first book, I was 15 months, right? And I come back with a pile of notes. There were probably 60 or 70 notebooks, and God knows how many recorded interviews and background. It's just a big chronological pile. But then what I got to do for the next 9 months, and maybe this would be of some benefit to the soldiers if they could do something so cathartic, is I got to revisit these things every day and take a pile of chronology and turn it into a story. Figure out, this is where I want to begin it. This is outlines. This is what I want to say. This is the ending I want to write to you. This is the feeling I want to convey, and this is the feeling I want to leave readers with. That's... To bring a narrative frame to something is, if I truly were a genius, I would patent it as a kind of therapy.
Yeah. Because is it true that maybe the writing is, or maybe the organization takes more of your time than the actual composition?
Sure. I mean, it's craft work to a certain point. It's making sense of the mess. It's organizing it into a story that, first of all, feels compelling, you hope is. Second, you know, well, no, not even second. The first obligation is to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth isn't the truth to the people I'm writing about, but a truth about them to readers who really don't care a lick about them, to somehow authentically represent what they went through. And that, look, you know, this was they had a rough deployment. They didn't know what they were getting into.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know. And they thought if they got into anything, they were going to succeed. They were going to prevail. They were going to win. And so by the end of it, that hadn't happened in most cases. They had become degraded. So I knew the ending, and then it's a matter of believing in the ending and shaping the material to get to that end.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does.
It's harder with this new book because the war ended, but the part these guys are in now, it is ongoing. It's unclear how it works out for these folks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a matter of going along, seeing them, oh my gosh, I mean, these brave people, allowing me to see them at the most painfully intimate, troubled moments of their lives, and then having faith in me that I'm going to write a book that will represent them accurately
and
in a dignified
Martin.
Way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
When you read David's book, you are sitting in the back seat or you are sitting in a chair in the corner of the living room and you're there, you're a transparent observer. You're not in your work. You disappear, which I think is such a magical quality, so rare these days. And I think in an era of kind of pitched battles about points of view, who's right and who's wrong. You really, I want to come back to something you said, though, about who's right and who's wrong. You said, I wanted to say something. I organized the material so I could figure out I wanted to say something. And I just wondered if you knew what that something is.
But I don't want to say it to a room full of folks who may not have read the books because I want them to come to their own conclusions. But you're right. I mean, my reporting method is not to interview so much as just to be along, to be the guy in the back seat. And I don't write about myself in these, but I mean, who cares? You know, right. I'm the journalist. It's their story. I would like to tell you one story about something that happened that I didn't put in the book. And to writers out there, it may be helpful because it's the moment that I knew I was done with the reporting and I was ready to write. So do you guys remember the picture? The last picture was Adam Schumann on his way home. So he had gone to... it's an amazing thing. He finally said, okay, I need help. And they looked around. They found this program in California, and he spends 5 months in this program, and it saves his life. And he's now driving home from the... He graduates, and he's driving home from the program with his wife, Saskia. And, of course, you know, I want to see the graduation, and I want to make the ride with them from California back to Kansas.
Which is a long drive, right?
It is a long drive. So what
happens?
And
they let you make it? Yeah.
You know, there's room in the back seat, and they stuck me in the back seat, and off they go. And their plan is to leave around sundown and keep driving straight through. And my plan is to stay awake because reporters don't go to sleep. And they're driving, you know, and maybe they stop for gasoline and bottles of water, and that's it. They keep going, and it's, I don't know, 1, 2 in the morning, and they're somewhere in Utah, and it's dark, and there's nothing around, and I'm in the back seat, and, you know, and I did the bad thing. I fell asleep. And to give you a sense of how nice a guy Adam Schumann is, he understands I'm asleep. He's driving. He doesn't want to wake me up, but he has to go to the bathroom. So he does this old Iraqi trick of he takes a water bottle and he basically pees in it as he keeps driving. Now, the way I know this, unfortunately, is, I don't know, maybe an hour later or so, I wake up and it's dark outside and I'm in the back seat and I'm a little thirsty. So I'm reaching around, you know. And I find my water bottle, and I take off the cap, and I take a big old swig. And a few minutes later, I think, I am so done with reporting this book. So I guess what I'm saying is if you get to the point where you're drinking someone's urine, you know everything you're going to know.
Yeah.
Isn't that awful?
That is really something. Oh, I just don't...
So get this. So the worst part is, I don't know what to do about this. I don't want to tell them what I've done. So I take out my phone, and I text my wife, who's on the East Coast.
It's like 3 o'clock in the morning.
But there, you know, it's 6 in the morning. So I send her a text saying,
honey, I just drank someone's urine.
No, I say, I'll explain later, but is it harmful to drink human urine? So she writes back a few minutes later. She goes, I've checked it out. It's okay one time to drink your own urine. So I text her back, I'll explain later. Oh. Can you imagine? That was awful.
A toast.
Anyway, it's not in the book. So it's a charming story, but that one ain't in the book, man.
No. And Adam found out.
Yeah.
Oh, that is.
Yeah, because at some point I said I may need to stop at a hospital. I don't. Anyway, he and his wife.
What does your wife do for a living?
I mean, she's an artist. And,
okay.
And
so she's not a nurse or a medical.
No. We've been married more than 30 years, and you know, somebody asked her earlier, "What does she think about this?" And it's my cheap answer, but it's also a true answer. One day she said, you have a war to go to or something like that?
Because you've been home for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. So, true.
It's, how does, how did, well, that's a great point, because I'm wondering how these books meshed with your family life. You have kids who are in college.
Right.
They've left. Did you bring this war home a lot with them at the dinner table?
So to this day, you know how you hear that guys come home from war and they never talk about it? I've never sat down and talked to my family about what I saw and some of the things that happened to me. And you know why? I poured it into the book, and they've read the book, so they know. But everything that happened is reflected in the book, and so there's no reason to have that conversation.
Right. I think you said something interesting to the Times the other day. You were talking about a Q&A you did, and they asked you how you came back from the good soldiers reporting that book. And by the way, there's an amazing photograph on the cover of the new book, Thank You for Your Service, which is we want to talk about in just a moment, but I want to read this quote. You replied to the question, how did you come back? And you said, I'm a little sadder than I used to be, mm-hmm. more grateful, less funny, more, I would disagree, but more private, more in need of doing things in a linear way, worse at typing, and happier than ever to end a day with a drink on my front porch.
Right.
I think of war now, not only intellectually, but viscerally, and I dream about it too, but not as much as I did a few years ago. I'm glad my friends now include soldiers and that their friends now include someone like me.
Right.
What did you mean by, I'm glad my friends now include soldiers and that their friends now include someone like me?
Well, so when I grew up, I had, it was the tail end of the Vietnam War, and I had a number, my lottery number, but it was a high number, and I wasn't called, so I didn't have to decide. Whether I would go or try to do something else. I'm not from a military family. My wife is, but big Air Force family, but I'm not. I had covered a few wars for the Washington Post, but I didn't understand or know very much about the military.
You grew up in coal country in Pennsylvania?
For a little while. Parents split up, and then I was up and down the East Coast, but it was... I mean, it wasn't easy, and actually, if I'm going to be forthcoming, one of the things that made this second book a little scary to me was in my upbringing, there had been a few years where my mom had been suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And so spending a couple of years in the company of folks who it was a day-to-day battle sometimes to stay alive, that was, and I knew I was getting into this. And it was a little scary to take it on. But even though the book isn't about me in any way, it's about them. And nonetheless, by spending so much time with the story, you do get the privilege of learning some things about yourself. And that was nice. But when I say my friends are now soldiers, I don't mean... I need to be clear. That's not when I was reporting.
Right.
I'm not going to be friends with these guys, and I make it clear to them that I'm not in it to be their friend. And there's always some signal of what our relationship is, a notebook, a tape recorder, something to let them know I want to hear every single thing they have to say, and I want to watch everything they're doing. But they can't lose sight of my point here, which is to represent all of this in a book. But after the book came out, I am friends with a couple of them mm-hmm. now, and I like that. And it expands me and... You know, I love these are dear friends, and mm-hmm. I'm also glad that in their experience, a lot of them didn't have a guy like me,
mm-hmm.
and now they do, and I think it works well both ways. That's all I meant.
It's I love that insight, because Thank You for Your Service actually includes World War II veterans, Korean yep. and Vietnam, as well as Iraq and Afghanistan. They're all represented in this book.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you what America Adam Schumann is returning to, as opposed to, say, your father, uncle, grandfather in World War II. How is America different today than 60-some years ago?
So the thing they're returning from is different times, different places, different decades. But, you know, when something happens where you were rattled to your core, when you're rattled to your bones, it doesn't matter what war it is, if it's a war, civilian life, you know, it's down to your bones. That's the same. And I imagine will forever be the same in any country, anytime. The difference now is that when guys came home from Vietnam feeling this way, there was no system in place at all.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing. And we all know the stories about when so many troops came home and how publicly reviled some of them were. We know our history. But one part of that history is they came home filled with the same kinds of things that Adam Schumann came home with. And they, just like World War II, just like Korea, just like all of them, no system in place to really help them. Now there is a system.
Mm-hmm.
It's a flawed system, however. It's overwhelmed. It's, and the book will show this. This is not my opinion. This is what you'll get as you follow these dear people through attempts to get help. It's a system filled with good intentions, absurd moments, heartbreaking moments, and moments where you realize this system of help, great, it's in place, that's nice, but it's overwhelmed, it's inconsistent. And
By some 500,000, perhaps, wounded soldiers out of the 2 million that may have...
Out of the 2 million. And I'm glad you said that, Doug, because look, 2 million people, of the 2.5 million people who have joined the services since 9/11, 2 million of those have gone directly into Iraq and Afghanistan. And of the 2 million, let me emphasize, most of them are fine. And as I say in the book, some of them are better for the experience. But 20 to 30%, which works out to about 500,000 people who went to these two places, have come home with some kind of mental wound. And then when you, the multiplier effect, now it's not just the guys in war, now they're here. And it's families as well. So when you add the multiplier effect, this is a significant number. And one of the things that interests me is some of the early reaction to the book has been from people who have been a little concerned that what the book is going to do is play into the stereotype of the broken soldier. And I was saying this to you earlier. I just don't get this.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fact is, not all, but some of these soldiers are broken by the experience.
Right.
And some of them bared their life to me so I could tell the story of what's going on. And to pretend otherwise, I think, would be disrespectful of what they're going through and what they've been through.
Because, as you say, it is a multiplying effect. I mean, they come. What can we do? And I don't know if you have an answer to this question. What do they want to hear from us as their neighbors, as their fellow voters?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because with so many people, there's not a consistent answer. Some want to hear nothing at all. Some want to hear the phrase, thank you for your service. Some are repulsed by the phrase because they find it to be an empty phrase. Some want to be left alone. Some want free drinks every time somebody shows up.
What is the title?
There's no consistent thing, but except for I think they would like people to realize it's not so easy as a stock phrase like thank you for your service. It's a little more complicated.
Where does the title come from for you? How do you mean it in this book?
Not in a judgmental way or ironic or a bitter way. Nothing like that. I just meant it as if you read the book, the stories between the covers, once you're done, these are some of the people you're thanking. And this is some of what you're thanking them for.
Mm-hmm.
Just it's a sense of conveying the chance for a deeper understanding.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, David Finkel reads from his book, Thank You for Your Service.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We return now to my conversation with David Finkel, author of The Good Soldiers and Thank You for Your Service.
I mean, I think that you write about what it means to try to be a good person in the least likely of moments. You know, I think when you look at Ayeti and these guys are all trying to do something. And I think you went into the maw of this book trying to do, although you would be loath to admit it, a, quote, good thing, or at least it was going to be a journey that you're going to haul the ore back and maybe something valuable would be mined here. And
these people have seen something most of us don't see,
right?
Over there, but they're not over here there anymore. They're back here, and now they're going through something. And they're wounded, but you know, they're everything else too. They're angry and they're funny and they're wonderful and they're irritating. And underneath it all, you know, maybe I'm in the tank for them a little bit, but in every one of them, I sense a fundamental decency, and that's something that's terribly moving to me.
Couldn't you say, though, then, reading your book, that, you know, it wasn't a good idea to send them overseas?
I'm not going to say that.
No.
No, they're entitled to say that. They can say that. They're the ones who went.
What did they tell you?
Some of them say it was a waste of time, and some of them say they will insist their dying day that it was worth it. And as far as I'm concerned, both are absolutely valid opinions for them to come to, because they were the ones who went, and they were the ones who did it.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that fascinating, that complexity?
It's a great thing to try to ferret out and write.
And you have
out.
To love it, don't you? Because
sure,
otherwise you'll go crazy. Well, if you try to make all these square pegs fit into this round
hole. Nothing tidy. And if there are any, you know, great truths in what these people have gone through and are going through, it's that it is an individual thing. There's no one size fits all.
There may not be an answer to this question, but I just am curious. We talk about it a lot on this stage. What is the story? Because to me, there's enough success to go around. Collegiality, contiguity is important. In some ways, I think we're all telling the same story.
Well, yeah, but right. There are only so many stories to tell, Doug. Right? There are only if you're writing toward emotion, especially these interior feelings we all have. There are only so many. Emotions to write about and so many stories to tell.
What do you think the two main stories are to write about?
Well, that's like asking what are the two guiding emotions of anyone's life? And I would like to think it's love would be... I'm sorry. I know how I sound. I just heard myself. I would like to think it's love, but I think it's loneliness, actually. And one of the compelling things about the second book was it's sort of to continue the psychological journey these guys started. They were invincible, and then they weren't. And by the end, it's that old war saying, "I'm only in it for the guy next to me."
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like this most loving, tender relationship. And mm-hmm. it was an amazing thing to see. And then they came home. And now it's not even about the guy next to you. There's shame in acknowledging that you might be suffering a mental wound. I had so many guys say to me, "If only I could look in the mirror and see a missing leg or a missing arm or some physical representation that I am in fact wounded, I might believe it myself. But to believe that there's something wrong with me mentally, no, I have a hard time accepting that." So they're not talking about it. They're loath to acknowledge it. And it's not even the guy next to him anymore. These are rather isolated, lonesome lives being led by some people who, well, hell's bells, man, they deserve better than that.
Mm-hmm. So what maybe we can do is just simply to live and breathe and be human. I mean, we don't maybe have to do anything out of the ordinary. Just
to be pretty nice.
To be present. A witness, maybe not as a writer, but...
I've had a lot of guys say it would be nice if somebody approached me not as if I'm a victim of something or an extreme member of society, but, you know, not come up and ask the gross question, "How many people did you kill, man?" Anything like that. "How are you doing? Are you wounded?" Anything like that. Just say, "What's going on?" Mm-hmm. Where were you? Did you serve? How was the food? Just start a normal conversation and see where it goes. And if the guy wants to tell you more, if you're lucky enough to hear more, then he'll tell you more. And if you're not, then don't take it personally. It's just the way it goes.
How do you define heroism, having written what you've written?
Well, let me answer it in the answers I've gotten from those guys, because they all, you can see them wince a bit when they're being called a hero. And that makes sense to me, because they were doing what they signed up to do. Now, they didn't know what they were getting into, but still they signed up for something. To me, if I can give an example of who a hero is, a hero would be Tesolo Ayeti, the guy who was blown up, the guy who, with a broken leg, made his way back to a Humvee catching on fire and helped pull out two wounded guys. The guy who then cracked open and had to go to and wrecked his apartment because of the dream he kept having. The guy who then, because of that, had to go to a treatment facility. And once he got out of that, he went to a 7-week VA-run PTSD treatment program, very good program. And on the day of his graduation, the person handing him the certificate said, "You define what a hero is." And everybody clapped. And Tesolo knew this is just BS, because at the end of the day, it didn't matter what anybody thought of him. It didn't matter how they defined him or regarded him. It came down to, in his most private places, how he thought of himself. And you know, what is heroism? It's you know, it's a guy who does something extraordinary and is still capable of feeling at some level a totally ununderstandable, if that's a word, sense of shame about something.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. It's interesting. Yeah, it's not often the strong guy or the fast guy or woman. It's, you know, you'd ask Ayeti, who did he think was watching when he pulled those people out? Was it God? Was it his
family? Yeah, isn't that a good
family?
Question?
But he just did it. And so to me, it's always been, person does the right thing even when no one's watching.
Well, so sort of a corollary of that. It's not precise, but let me shift it a little bit. Why is it, and the book doesn't answer it, why is it you can have two guys side by side and the same thing happens, the same explosion, the same effects of the explosion, maybe the same shrapnel, whatever it is, the same wounds, and one guy absorbs it, is affected by it, absorbs it, and somehow moves on. And somebody else, for whatever reason, is hobbled for the rest of his life by it. What is that about? And it's been studied and studied. And, you know, I tried to get therapists to talk about it. So one guy I thought had a very good answer who was running a program. He said, so it doesn't matter who you are in the moment of trauma, because you're not in control. But it's that first moment after, that first moment after where you regain control, how you behave in that moment, how you think you behave, brave, cowardly, whatever it is, that defines how hobbled you are by trauma. Now, I thought that made a lot of sense.
Is that what tells
But then there was another guy.
Okay.
Then there was another guy. I said, yeah, that's pretty interesting. But I think it's this, based on the therapies I've done. It's not who you were in the first moment after trauma, it's who you were in that last moment before the trauma. It's who your life up until then had patterned you to be, and that's going to define how you behave in the moment after. So if you can tease your life apart, if you can have time in therapy to tease your life apart and figure out all the things in play that made you react the way you think you reacted, then you're going to have an easier time accepting it. Isn't that something? I thought that was interesting.
Is that the definition of PTSD? Tell us so that we leave here tonight and we know what that really means. We say that word a lot, but do we know?
There's just some traumatizing event, some terrifying event that has psychological consequences.
And post-traumatic
stress disorder.
Okay.
And there's some argument whether it should be a disorder or something else, but that's what it is. It's It manifests itself in symptoms such as anxiousness, depression, nightmares, suicidal ideation, the whole gamut. And there are a lot of guys with it. And so, now, as I said earlier, now we have a system to deal with it. But, oh my gosh, if you spent time in the system, it's some days it's encouraging, but some days you just see guys. There's one guy in the book. He was on 43 different medications a day. Okay, that's what he had been prescribed. And it's not just one anti-anxiety drug. He'd be on one, and if it wasn't working for him, they'd prescribe another to help mitigate the effects of the first one. So he laid them out for me one day. How many antidepressants? How many anti-anxieties? He had one sleeping pill to help him get to sleep, and then, since he would always wake up, another sleeping pill to help him get back to sleep of a different type than the first one. So this guy, yes, he was getting through his days, but he was zombie-like. Love was gone, capacity for love, sex, everything was just kind of wiped out. And on paper, he was doing okay because he was still alive. But, man, that's a long fight back from those meds.
Do women get PTSD?
Yes, 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 yes. And so one of the great things I got to do in this book was not just write about guys of war, but families in the after-war. And there are some amazing, amazing women in this book. They are so strong and they are so interesting. And a lot of them are realizing, you know what? I have it too.
Maybe now is a good time to read a section from Thank You for Your Service, because I think you're going to read about a woman. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would like to. That's
yeah,
all right.
Would you do that?
Yeah.
Let us hear some of this amazing book.
Okay, so it'll take a few minutes. But it's about, do you remember the photographs I showed at the beginning, and there was one photograph of a woman outside of her house, walking away from the house, a woman named Amanda Doster, who whose husband was killed in the war. And and it's several years later, and she's trying to get better. She's trying to recover from this, but at this point in the book, it's not happening for her. And this is a scene in her life where she is packing up to move away from the house she lived in, the last place she lived with her husband, the place they rang the doorbell to tell her that he had died and that she had gotten a death benefit, and that was helping to buy her a new house. And on her good days, she called that money oops money, and on her bad days, she called it blood money. But here's a short section about her packing up with her friend Sally. How do some people move on? Why isn't she one of those people? She has asked this of friends, counselors, and other widows. Now she asks no one anymore except God and Sally, of whom she can ask anything, even whether James is really dead. Because the thing is, she is still seeing him alive. Just the other day, she was driving and spotted him at a stoplight behind the wheel of a truck for a pest control company, and it was so clear to her what had happened. He had become bored with the war. He had left it. He was back in Kansas, lying low, waiting till the coast was clear, working pest control, saving money, and soon would be home, ringing the doorbell. There have been plenty of versions of this over the years, going back to when she saw him in the coffin and wondered if it was him. She wanted evidence. She knew his wedding ring had been removed, but she also knew it fit so tightly it left an indentation in his finger that never went away. She needed to see the indentation. She discreetly tried to remove the glove he had been dressed in for his viewing, but to her horror, as she pulled on the glove, she realized that it had been taped into place. He's alive, she began thinking. He's gone covert. This is a wax figure. That's why the glove is taped. It's all a ruse. She would prove it. And so she stood at the coffin, running her fingers back and forth over the glove, trying to feel the dent. Sally is the one who gets to hear this. She listens to Amanda with the endless patience of someone who spent a few years teaching emotionally disturbed children, three of whom left bite marks in the fleshy part of her right hand, and one with a mother whose tooth fell out in the midst of a parent-teacher conference. Do you have any super glue? The embarrassed woman had asked, holding the tooth. And so Sally understands that life has its complications and sadnesses, including in Kansas. She is also a cheerful person, which Amanda needs, and someone who likes to hum as she goes about her day, which Amanda doesn't mind at all, not from Sally, except for the time she was absent mindedly humming Taps, giving it a peppy bounce. Excuse me. Humming away now, she and Amanda are packing up the master bathroom when she suddenly falls silent. She is looking at the contents of a drawer she pulled out. Men's deodorant, men's shaving cream, a half-empty tube of toothpaste, a toothbrush with hardened bristles, unused for years. "I'll move that drawer, Sally," Amanda says. "What?" Sally says, still looking. "I'll move that drawer," Amanda says. Sally never met James, who had already deployed by the time she and Amanda became close. She knew him only from what Amanda described, 12 years older than her, the love of her life, her rescuer. Now Sally is the rescuer, and she has been since she stood with Amanda as Amanda faced her children to tell them what had happened. Grace, who looked so much like her father, was 3, and Catherine was 6, old enough to always be haunted by what her mother was about to say. "Don't use euphemisms," Amanda had been advised. "Don't say Daddy went to sleep. Don't say Daddy went away. Be truthful. Be direct." "Daddy got hurt," she began, and the next sound in the room came from Catherine, a sharp intake of breath. "Here's his nail file," Amanda says now, standing next to Sally, cleaning out the drawer. She picks up his nail file and then a blue plastic case with a dental mold in it. "What's that for?" Sally asks. "His sleep apnea?" "No, grinding his teeth," Amanda says. And for a moment, he is alive and grinding his teeth, and she can hear it.
Thank you.
Let's open up to our friends in the audience.
Yes.
And I know you'll be glad to answer some questions.
Jack Siegel, thank you very much for coming and for your book, The Good Soldiers. There was a sequence where Colonel Kozlerich meets with General Petraeus, and they both leave happy that things are going so well. Mm-hmm. And yet the soldiers are telling a different story throughout, and I really admire how you didn't inject your opinion throughout that book. But I'm a little worried by that as well, because right now we're making a decision as to whether to stay in Afghanistan after 2014, and it seems like the administration is heading to a decision to do that. And the silence from the community, this community included, is deafening, that no one in Washington is hearing how it looks from here. I'm concerned that the stories that we're getting about the individual soldiers is so detached from the day-to-day lives of the population that they are simply stories. They are stories of those who went. Yes, it's 2 million people, but they're spread over a whole country, and it's spread over a long period of time. So I'm wondering if maybe either your next project or you can find some ideas for how the people can express to their elected representatives what we should be doing in these situations.
No, I like the question, but no, I can't do that, and I won't do that because that would be then I'd be kind of doing all the things that I admire when other people do it, but I don't have those moves. I can't do that. But you know, you write, and there are plenty of people who write, and maybe I disagree a little bit with the distance in a story. And can I take a minute and explain mm-hmm. that day with Petraeus?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think if you tell a story well enough, then something becomes indelible. And so I want to talk about that day. Because I usually couch it this way when I'm teaching writing to people. I talk about the hardest line to write in the first book, the line that was difficult for me. And here's the line: "That's a toe," he said. It's a quote: "That's a toe," he said. Here are the circumstances. Petraeus, in 2007, as part of his battlefield circulation, comes to visit this unit. I have a few minutes to do this.
You sure do, okay. Yeah.
Comes to visit this unit. Petraeus, at that point, had just left Washington. This is September 2007, where he had testified before Congress about how the surge is going. Huge event. This guy is a rock star. Leaves. Goes back to Iraq. It so happens a couple weeks later, his battlefield circulation brings him to this unit, where he is sitting shoulder to shoulder with this battalion commander, Ralph Kozlerich, who would never briefed a 4-star in his life and was thrilled for the opportunity. and started telling him about one of the successes of his unit and what they were doing. There had been the lines at gas stations, the wait to get your gas tank filled could take as long as 2 days. And it's because the gas stations were controlled by the insurgents who were using the money to build bombs, basically to blow up soldiers. They were shaking people down. So what Kosler decided to do was to put a platoon of his soldiers at this gas station right across from the base they were on, put a platoon of soldiers there to stand guard, basically. And there was some adjustment, but it worked. And over time, the two-day wait was, in some cases, down to 15 minutes. This made people very happy. And Kosserich is telling Petraeus this, and Petraeus stops him, interrupts him, and says, I know about this. We need to do more of this throughout Baghdad. So there weren't a lot of good days, but this was a great day for Ralph Kosserich. David Petraeus had just said to him, we know about this. We need to do more of this. Petraeus leaves. It's a couple hours later. Kosserich is standing outside, and he's still glowing about this. It's a beautiful day. Perfect blue sky. And as he's talking about this, there's the sound of an explosion. Swivels his head. Nothing in the sky. Wait, beat, two, three. And here comes that gross, sick coil of black smoke coming in the air. And it was coming from the gas station. And what had happened, oh, it just gets worse. What had happened is this: the platoon of soldiers, they were done for the day. They were coming back to the base, and a guy timed the trigger perfectly, and one of these roadside bombs went into a Humvee containing five guys, including Josh Reeves. Josh Reeves, who that morning, his wife had given birth to their first child, and as soon as he got back to the base, he was going to call the hospital back in Kansas. And instead, he was shredded by this thing. And Kosserich goes running down to the aid station, and you know I go along, and we're all down there as Josh Reeves is brought in. And it's this, I mean, I'm not kidding, Petraeus had just left. Okay, so this is what's going on and more. And now this glow has shifted to this gurney where Josh Reeves is stripped down and he's surrounded by people trying to keep him alive. And you know, I mean, they're just injecting him with whatever and they're pumping on his chest so violently that, I'm sorry, but pieces of him are dropping to the floor. And at one point, a nurse is trying to tidy up, and she inadvertently kicks something that goes skidding across the floor and comes to rest against my boot. And the guy next to me looks down, and he says, that's a toe. Okay, so Josh Reeves dies. And now it's a few months later, and I'm home with this pile of notes, and I'm trying to turn it into this book. And I'm writing that day, the amazing day of the Petraeus visit and the death of Josh Reeves. And I get to that line. That's a toe. And I know as a writer, that is a great line because what you're trying to do is in the most minimal, efficient way possible, transport a reader out of the comfort of his or her life and directly into the thing you're writing about. And against everything, that's a toe. Three words, no adjectives, nothing like that, but just so specific. That's a great sentence. On the other hand, you know, I'm a parent, and I had kids at that point who were the age of Josh Reeves, and Josh Reeves also has parents and a wife and a new baby, and they all know he died, but they don't know the details. And suddenly, some book is going to appear, and maybe they'll read it, and maybe they're reading that scene, and then they get to that line, that's a toe. Do I want to put that in the book? Do I want to do that to them? And I went back and forth on that line, and I tried to write it without it, and then with it, and then without it, and I finally decided to put it in. So it's in the book, and I think it was the right decision. But a few months later, after the book came out, I got an email one day, and the subject line said, from the father of Josh Reeves. Oh, my gosh. Well, it turned out to be a beautiful email, a long email. And somewhere in that email was language such as, my family and I want to thank you for writing about the end of our son's life, because without that account, we wouldn't have known anything, and because of that, we got to be present in some way in the last few minutes of our son's life. So we will be eternally grateful to you. But, you know, it could have gone the other way. And just as valid, they could have written, and, you know, I've said this before, they could have written, you are a vulture. How dare you take the most private moment in our son's life and write the way you did about it. So this is a very long way to say, I like your question, and I like what you're trying to write, but for what I do, I think there's value in telling a story so specifically. It doesn't mean anybody will read it, but it's not up to me to get readers. It's up to me to write it well, and I think if you read that story, it's not a story over there anymore. It's a story inside of you.
And the asker of the question may also be asking or suggesting that maybe one of us needs to go to Afghanistan and write that book. Right, I mean, that, is that buried maybe in the question? I mean,
well, I don't know. I mean, people have gone to Afghanistan and written versions.
But maybe also, Jack, you know, it's curious why we're not talking about Afghanistan. I don't know if you want to go there at the moment, but maybe we're just tired.
Well, but we might not be talking about Afghanistan specifically, but I do think we're talking, to some degree, or we're surrounded by the effects of Afghanistan. It doesn't have to be a conversation about that. The first book was not about the Iraq War. It was using the Iraq War to write about something larger, the character of young men who live in our communities. And the second book is not about people have come home screwed up from the Iraq War. It's using the situation of the afterwar to write in a broad way about these are the effects of what we ask people to do. So to me, the discussion doesn't have to be about Iraq or Afghanistan, which always becomes inflamed and is filled with numbers and statistics that just become numbing after a while. If you tell stories and you tell stories well about the people who live among us, that's part of the deal.
You're saying this as a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who won that Pulitzer, solo Pulitzer, by going to Yemen and writing about U.S. democracy programs in Yemen, which I imagine were stories filled with facts and figures and policy. So you are a master at your craft so that you can do both, I think, that you can.
Well, I think you have to know the facts and figures, but I leave as many of them out as I can.
There you go. I like, all right.
You got to know the stuff, but that doesn't mean you have to include the stuff.
Listen, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah,
that was David Finkel at the National Writers Series, talking with Doug Stanton. David Finkel is the author of The Good Soldiers, and Thank You for Your Service. Finkel is the national editor at the Washington Post, the recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship for Journalism, and a Pulitzer Prize winner. The next program from the National Writers Series features poet Nikki Giovanni in conversation with Lee Haber. Giovanni is the author of 27 books. The latest is a collection of poetry called Chasing Utopia. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.